we will go on to the last case of the day, which is 034340, Lynette Manny versus John Potter. Okay. Morning, Mr. Andre. How are you?
May it please the court, counsel. This is a situation where Lynette Manny, who was a 19-year postal employee, faced discrimination from the first time she even applied based on a perceived handicap, a situation where she was diagnosed as paranoid schizophrenic, but nonetheless was under treatment, medication, and therapy. In order for her to even work there, it was required that she have union intervention and arbitration. And despite that fact, her supervisors perceived her as having a disability, even though she competently performed all of her work and even though she completed a bachelor's degree. She's enduring an environment of small-minded and uncompassionate managers who berated her as being, quote, crazy almost daily, and that she, quote, could not do the work.
Let me ask you this. On the hostile work environment claim, where will we find evidence that the offensive comments were made directly to Ms. Manny or were made in her presence? Because it certainly seems as if most of the talk, was going on behind her back.
Well, the cases hold that in terms of hostile work environment, even if they were going on behind her back, but she became aware of them, that doesn't lessen the hostility environment. In fact, it makes it even more difficult when all your coworkers all around you are being told that you're crazy and that you can't perform the work. That's worse than if you were directly confronted and then you could challenge what was being said. What she was directly challenged with was that they didn't want her complaining about the fact that they were calling her crazy, saying that she wasn't competent to work. So they were clearly aware of that. And what she was directly confronted with when she initially applied was that they felt that she was not competent to do the job, and it was only with union intervention that she was able to even stay on the job. So,
but there's a distinction in hostile environment cases between measures undertaken by co-employees, measures undertaken by supervisors, for example, and rightly or wrongly, one could certainly debate the point, but not right now. This circuit has a rather high standard for what makes the workplace so intolerable that it becomes effectively a discriminatory workplace, discrimination through harassment.
And that
you might want to distinguish the Silk case, for instance.
Well, and that's the point. The point of Silk didn't have a daily repetition of someone being called crazy to their coworkers, and these were, in fact, supervisors who were making these statements concerning my client. So, more to the point was the hostile work environment part of this case wasn't decided by a jury, and that's the whole point.
Well, that's why we're saying look at Silk, because we draw a distinction between, let's say, the unpleasant workplace and one which the evidence, if believed by the jury, would support a finding that it actually amounts to harassment. Obviously, the hostile work environment is one of the old branches of harassment law, and that itself is now have been folded into a somewhat different framework, but we require pretty severe conduct before we would give that kind of question to a jury.
Yeah, but what we have here is evidence, and we presented it in the form of Mr. Edmund, I forgot his last name, but his affidavit stated daily this is what was taking place. Daily. One of the other witnesses pointed out that her name was being announced over the PA system to go home early, unlike everybody else. Daily, she was being harassed by her supervisors, not by just coworkers, but by supervisors. This was a daily episode that she was going through, dreading to come to work every single day. The Silk case talked about episodic situations, something over here and something over there. That's not what was taking place here. And at a bare minimum, a jury should have been able to make a determination about whether this particular environment, these particular facts, were so severe and offensive, and particularly given the context of where she's trying to do her work and think, and she's being told that she's crazy, you know, that she can't perform, that, you know, we can't give you assignments because we need live bodies. This is a situation, particularly for a federal government agency. This is extremely offensive, particularly when it's the federal government that's promoting the idea that someone who either is handicapped or perceived as handicapped, but really he can do this job, has the right to do that job.
Let's talk about the retaliation claim. What adverse action is Ms. Manny claiming was taken against her? If it was the refusal to give her overtime, is that it?
No, it's the fact that she wasn't allowed to work the same number of hours per week as those who had no psychological claims of any disability. And she had been told specifically that they did not want her to complain of discrimination. So that was something that was directly told to her face.
I'd like to reserve
the balance of my time for rebuttal.
Okay, thank you. Mr. Lorenzen, good afternoon.
May it please the court, counsel. The district court got it exactly right when it dismissed both the hostile work environment and the retaliation claims in summary judgment. It also got it right when it excluded the testimony of Edmund Lindsay about comments allegedly made by a supervisor who had no contact with Ms. Manny from 1997 to the year 2000, when Ms. Manny first complained that she wasn't getting enough scheduled hours or the right to work overtime.
Let's focus on the hostile work environment claim first, because as you know, the standard is phrased in the disjunctive, severe or pervasive conduct, and Ms. Manny's theory is obviously on the pervasive side of that line. Daily insults based on her disability don't...
Your Honor, what I would point out first about that is that's not supported in the record. The only testimony that would have come about the calling you crazy on a daily basis would have come from Edmund Lindsay. And it is very important that the offer of proof on that was an affidavit in which Mr. Lindsay himself said that Ms. James, I only saw these comments until, I believe he said, February of 1997. And at the conference regarding this evidence before the second day of trial, Ms. Manny's attorney admitted that Phyllis James, who was the supervisor who allegedly was calling her crazy on a daily basis, had left the Chicago Post office and had no role in supervising Ms. Manny after that point. So at the very onset, I would dispute that the record contains daily comments of her being crazy at a time relevant to the events that Ms. Manny complained about, namely her...
This gets to this timing point where the district court, you know, obviously the hostile environment claims are the kinds of claims that can build up over time. They're not single incident points. But there's absolutely nothing that ties this closer to 2000 than the Lindsay affidavit?
In fact, it's pretty clear because, as Judge Ropener pointed out, these comments were being made behind Ms. Manny's back. That's the story.
Right.
And so Ms. Manny didn't testify about it. The other two people who testified were a woman, I'm not sure I'm pronouncing this correctly.
Well, by testified, do you mean affidavit submitted in support of the summary judgment?
Both. These two other people testified at trial, but they also submitted affidavits.
Well, we need to see what was before the district court at the summary judgment.
At summary judgment. And at summary judgment, they were consistent, actually. But at summary judgment, the affidavit of this woman, Ila Pettius, went simply to the fact that she saw, or she also put words in her mouth a little bit, that she saw Ms. Manny being sent home on a daily basis or paged to come back from cigarette breaks. She didn't testify about hearing comments on a daily basis that she was being called crazy. The other witness that submitted an affidavit and then later testified at trial was Miriam Graham, and her comment was that she thinks that she heard a supervisor tell Ms. Manny to get out of a work unit that she wasn't assigned to. This idea, this notion that there was testimony or affidavits on summary judgment of the that Ms. Manny was crazy on a daily basis, the only affidavit that was submitted on that was from Mr. Lindsay, and he explicitly says in the affidavit, and later at trial counsel admitted, that only occurred, if it occurred at all, we would debate that it occurred, but it's in summary judgment, of course, we have to assume it's true, up until 1997. Because Ms. James was gone by that point.
There's no mention of the Rule 56.1 statements. Were they filed in the district court?
Yes, sir.
Okay.
Yes. So we believe when you basically take the facts that were before the district court on summary judgment, the decision on the retaliation claim to grant summary judgment is absolutely proper. This court has said that you've got two routes to establish a retaliation claim. You can either do it with direct evidence, without inferences drawn from circumstantial evidence, and that was specifically stated in the Stone case, or you can do it by doing a comparative analysis of other employees that allegedly were in the same condition, same basic facts, except they didn't file any EEO complaints and they were treated better. Very clear from the record on summary judgment that analysis was never engaged in. The plaintiff never submitted such evidence. And for the first time on appeal, and nowhere in the record on summary judgment, we have a statement in the brief that says that the plaintiff was told by her supervisors that they took a dim view of her EEO complaints. That is not in the record on summary judgment. And in fact, I think it's noteworthy to note that it doesn't even have a record cite in the brief before the court. We also believe that the hostile work environment claim was properly granted on summary judgment simply because of the comparison to the Silk case. In Silk, we have comments that were made directly to Sergeant Silk while he was standing at a morning roll call, calling him basically with a lot of vulgarity, complaining that his medical limitations were baseless and that he was taking advantage of them. We even have a captain who was in charge of Sergeant Silk saying directly to Sergeant Silk, you might want to check under your car every once in a while because there might be a bomb under it at some point. And these are very serious allegations. Now, this court looked at those as a whole and separately and said, you know, based on things like, well, the sergeant may not really have taken the bomb comment seriously, things like that, that it just didn't amount to a hostile work environment claim. Here, we've got alleged comments made behind Ms. Manny's back. We've got a situation where she is able to do her job, and she even testifies that she likes her job. It doesn't interfere at all with her job, assuming that all of these things are true. And these comments date back, we know for a fact, at least prior to 1997 when Ms. James left. Lastly, I'd like to deal with the whole issue of whether or not the evidence of Edmund Lindsay, which goes to this issue, was properly excluded. The point there is that Ms. Manny's counsel, the morning of when that issue came up, basically told the judge, I don't think you're going to let me introduce this evidence that I'd like to introduce. And Judge Pallmeyer very clearly said, no, I don't think you got it right. I didn't say that you couldn't introduce evidence that was earlier than the year 2000 or thereabouts. What I said was you can't base your claim on that. But if it supports your claim about the events in the year 2000, you can bring it. At that point, rather than make an argument that, yes, this testimony of Edmund Lindsay will relate to the events of 2000, Ms. Manny's counsel simply offered the affidavit as an offer of proof. Well, no argument that evidence should be admitted. Judge Pallmeyer, at the very least, should have had the benefit of the argument that the plaintiff now makes for the first time in her brief, that somehow those comments by Phyllis James back in 1997 and earlier somehow influenced the supervisors 3 years later to deprive Ms. Manny of overtime and the more scheduled hours. The last point that I want to make is, let's assume for the moment that somehow Judge Pallmeyer was way wrong and it was an abuse of her discretion to exclude that evidence. It clearly was not harmless error. And we know that from two
I think
very
you mean was harmless error.
I'm sorry.
Too many nods.
I misspoke. Thank you. It was clearly harmless error. We know that for two reasons. First of all, the evidence at trial established clearly that Ms. Manny, who was complaining that she wasn't given enough scheduled hours, never asked for more scheduled hours. There was testimony that she never filled out any paperwork on that from the human resources manager, John Richardson. And in addition, her supervisor said she never came to me orally and said, boy, I'd like to work more hours. Moreover, the testimony was very clear, both at the summary judgment stage and at the trial stage, that she had never asked to sign the overtime desired list. And that's the vehicle that her supervisors use when overtime is necessary. So unless the court has further questions, we believe that the decision of the district court should be affirmed.
Thank you, Mr. Lorenzen. Mr. Andre?
Counsel argues that there's no connection between Doris or between Phyllis James' statements back in 97 and her current supervisor at the time, Doris Waiters. But in fact, Ms. Waiters...
I'm not sure, you know, I mean, I think what he's arguing is that you had an opportunity there.
And we made it. There was a motion in limine that had been filed prior to that, and it was based on that the judge had made a decision that you couldn't go into matters past the year 2000. So rather than to go forward and just gang tackle the situation and ignore the motion in limine that had been filed, I alerted the court what I planned to do and asked the court what her position would be with regard to this testimony. I presented the affidavit to show that, in fact, what the testimony would show. And the argument obviously was that the motion in limine should not hamper that testimony. The judge ruled that I still couldn't present that evidence, that specific evidence. And it turns out that during the trial, Doris Waiters indicates that the only reason that the hours were limited was because of what the prior supervisor had done. The prior supervisor had set those hours in stone, and she was simply following what the prior supervisor had done. So it's the prior supervisor's motivation that determined what her hours were, not Ms. Waiters, her current supervisor. So it was, in fact, relevant to what was taking place at the trial. Also,
will we find where you explain that to Judge Pallmeyer in the record?
Yes, that is in the record when we talked. Plus, that's in the motion in limine hearings that we had and the motions in limine in response that were filed. So it was because of the motions in limine that the limitation was made, and we were simply responding. We did not want to be disrespectful to the court and put on a witness to where she's already ruled on a motion in limine, you're not supposed to do this. So I simply wanted to make my record that I still persisted in my position that this witness should be able to testify to these things, but not at the same time be disrespectful to the court in front of a jury and have someone take the stand to do exactly what she said I'm not supposed to do. So the record was made, and the offer of proof, in this case even in writing, was in fact submitted. Also, counsel says that my client never asked for additional hours, but we pointed out, and Mr. Richardson conceded this point, that my client's complaints always argued about the fact that she wasn't allowed to get additional hours. Mr. Richardson tried to say that because she didn't put it on a specific type of form that nobody told her that she could file, that that's the reason that she didn't get the additional hours. But in fact, the complaints of discrimination themselves focused on the fact that she wasn't getting additional hours. So Mr. Richardson, who processes those complaints, can't say that he didn't know that she wanted additional hours like everybody else was getting. So for those reasons, we feel that the decisions of the district court should be reversed. My client should be allowed a trial on the harassment, and also should be allowed to reopen the discrimination case to put in the evidence that was excluded.
Thank you, Mr. Andre. Well, thanks to Mr. Andre and to Mr. Lorenzen. The case will be taken under advisement, and this court will stand in recess until tomorrow morning at 9:30.